This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. With me is James J. Patterson, who has written a new book, and it's called Junk Shop Windows, and we're going to hear all about it. James, what is this book about? What's in it?
Well, this book is a collection of essays that are primarily autobiographical, but I've also thrown in a little touch of speculative fiction into this to give it kind of a Twilight Zone feel. And whereas my last book of essays was an exploration of creative nonfiction using a form that Henry Miller invented called spiral form. And I was going to attempt to do that again with this one because I had so much fun doing the first one. But as I started writing, it really became much more personal, and everything was true. So I stopped using phony names and started using real names, and I turned it into autobiography.
A book of you. It's called The Book of You.
And that's a sweet
fabulous book. Fabulous book. Okay, let me tell you what I think. Yeah. I've read your stuff for years, but I think this, and I've always known you were a bookworm. I mean, everybody knows that.
Mm-hmm.
But in this book, I saw that you really have earned your stripes as a literary scholar and a literary critic and a social critic. But more than anything, I am so impressed with the way that we got fresh ground broken with old literature, really. Talk about how you write in a colloquial way so that you talk it on the page. So you write the way you talk, and most people write the way they write, which is so boring. How do you do that?
Well, when I walk into my office and I'm going to be in there for a while writing, I walk into that room, it's full of books, and I consider these books to be people. They're my friends. They're sitting on shelves with their legs dangling down, welcoming me back into the atmosphere that they've created for me. And aww. So it's colloquial, I guess, in the sense that these are my pals. There's Voltaire sitting there. There's Balzac sitting over there. Here's Henry Miller over here. Here's Alice Munro sitting there side saddle on my bookshelf. And so I feel like I'm in a community of spirits when I'm writing, you know. And so it is a conversation that I have with people that are very alive to me.
It comes out that way too. There's philosophy here, there's reminiscences, there's memoir, social commentary. And James Patterson is known to be a student of history, literature, sports, music, film, and otherwise. And let's hear just a little bit of the book to begin with. And the book is called Junk Shop Window: Essays on Myth, Life, and Literature.
All right. Well, I'll read you a little piece from one of my favorites in the book, and it's called The Memory of Tomorrow. It is 10 till 2 a.m. on a Thursday morning in late January. A winter storm has temporarily cut off the power. Many candles burn. The candlelight loves the heavy red velvet curtains, the cranberry wallpaper with images, all the color of copper turned teal green, of nymphs and flower urns. A stick of amber incense adds a subtle sweetness to the atmosphere, an atmosphere that wants poetry and good red wine. Rose sleeps upstairs. The house is quiet. The neighborhood is quiet, in the way that only a slow, heavy snowfall can hush the world. It is the memory of quiet that makes me look up from my book and take in the candlelight. The quiet invokes a familiar feeling. It's a feeling I realize I've had many times before, but once it passes, I forget about it until it returns. And as I return to my reading, reveling in the delicious cadences of long, well-written poems, the ingenuity of revealed wisdoms, the unexpected turns of thought that can surprise even after many readings over many years, I am suddenly aware of a background ambiance. Pausing to listen, I recognize it, a comforting sound, familiar all the way to my bones. I smile and return to my reading when I suddenly have the kind of wait-a-minute revelation I will often have when I detect that something is very out of order, because the sound that has comforted me late at night at times like this throughout my life is not possible. It is the clippity-clop sound of a horse trotting on cobblestones in the snow, pulling a small carriage in the night. The book I'm reading falls to the floor. Almost worried, partly amused, I stand and walk to the window. I can see snow falling slow and steady between the houses. I go to the front door, pull it open, and step out onto the sheltered front step. The cold is thrilling. Breathing it in has a purifying effect on my lungs. Was I half expecting to see gas lamps out on the street and a carriage coming up the hill in the snow? Maybe I was, but the power is out and all is hush and dark. The snow falling has a soft sound of air moving gently. It tastes like electricity. Sometimes a snowfall like this one actually warms the air somewhat. Friction, I suppose. But it is too cold to stand here all night, although I want to. The veil between worlds has become very thin. How do I know that? Because each of my senses is being called to it. The senses I know and think I can direct, and the ones I'm not aware of. They are searching for a thread after taking a hint. In this state, I doubt anything could surprise me. If an ancestor I've not heard of, maybe one who looks a little like me, male or female, or even some hound or other animal familiar, should step out of the falling snow and hand me something I need, or impart a piece of advice, warning, or merely a comfort, I would accept it. If that creature stepped out of the snow and demanded a gift, I would give it. I turn my head slowly side to side, encouraging those senses to reach out and explore. I am tempted to make a slow, sideways movement, like a Tai Chi gesture, a secret step, and if I do it properly, an open sesame will occur. I will see the Pythagorean angles in time all around, and if I want to, I could slip between them, becoming myself an adumbration, and I would be standing in another time, another now, as another me.
James J. Patterson, it doesn't get better than that. That I'm afraid you're hiding away as a poet. That prose is pure silk. Wow. And also, there's so much depth to so many of your essays. Now, that is kind of a meditative one, and it is almost verging, well, it's really poetic prose. And some of your other work is very clear and crisp criticism. I am taken very much with your work on Henry Miller and D.H. Lawrence. And I didn't know about this extensive relationship. And to tell you the truth, I didn't like Henry Miller till I read your work. And I love Lawrence. Mm-hmm. So you have so much intimate knowledge about, for instance, that relationship. Did you, over the years, collect notes as you read on them? I know you read the letters and everything. Or do you just read all their works and then it's in your DNA and then you wrote about it? What's your process?
A little bit of both. You know, I first stumbled across Henry Miller when I was a much younger man. I was in my 20s, and I had had a couple of businesses and they both went south. And I had this one business called Baker Street Limited, and we were managing music bands and we were doing radio plays. And in the middle of setting up this business, we got thrown out of the house we were in, and I couldn't afford to keep it all going and get a new spot. Well, I had my folks had a place up in Canada, and so I left Washington and went up there to reinvent myself. And I was a pretty forlorn guy, you know. I had this big life. I was getting it all going, and all of a sudden, and suddenly it all crashed around me. And so I was sitting up there on an island called Clovelly on a lake called Lovesick in Canada. And I had a copy of Tropic of Cancer that somebody had gave me when I left town. And on the first page of Cancer, he says something like, I have no hopes. I have no money. I'm the happiest man alive. He says, a year ago, 6 months ago, I thought that I was an artist. I no longer think about it. I am.
So and, he actually spoke for you.
Oh, he gave me permission to shed all the preconceptions I had about who I should be and what I wanted to be and let me be me.
Really, James? You and can identify that pivot in your life?
Right.
That then is so extraordinary. That's extraordinary.
I was a different man from that day forward.
Well, that is a, I know it's in your book also. I have to talk about the venerable Rose Solari, the great poet who you happen to be married to. And what amuses me so much is sometimes you're writing with Rose asleep upstairs. So she becomes a character off stage, which we never see, but is one, like one of the most important characters in the play. What is a literary marriage like? Do you read each other books?
Well,
I know you buy each
other
books.
Yeah, I think it's kind of unique. You know, I love collaboration. And I had, in a previous incarnation, I was a songwriter. And I did 5 or 6 albums, and we toured all over the country all the time. And he and I had a really good rapport when it came to shedding ideas, getting new ideas, fleshing out ideas. And it was really, really great. And then when I fell in with Rose, well, she's a poet and a novelist and a playwright, as you know, and she's real good at what she does. And because she's good at what she does, she has enough confidence that she's not threatened by me or my work in any way. And she's the best damn editor anybody ever saw.
True. And there's no competition either. I've noticed there's collaboration without competition, which is very unusual.
Well, it's
right.
It has
to do with her cooking. I think it's because she's a good cook.
Oh, her last name ends with a vowel, so she's Italian.
There's a win right there.
There's a win right there, huh?
Name some of the things you love: books, sports, film, friendship. Talk about them. They're all in the book.
Well, I love life, and you know, I loved my mom. My mom and I were like this. We talked every day at 10 o'clock in the morning. And it was just great. And so I love women too, because I love my mother. I think that's it. So I've always
got in the book. There's a great, you actually bring her to life. And the thing about writing is that she will last longer than we will, because she's in this book. You bring her vividly to write. And so you treat each segment of your life very differently. Some are memoir, some are anecdote, exegesis, meditation. And it's like all the little shards of your life came together. Did you collect these essays, or did you write them all new?
I keep two journals. One is a writing journal, which is just writing down things I have to remember because I want to get back to them later. And then I keep another journal of just what are my impressions of my life as I live it. I probably make 2 entries in it a week. A couple of these essays in Junk Shop Window were lifted literally from the pages of my journal.
But not published before.
No. So like the one I just read from, Memory of Tomorrow, I did write that sitting up late at night during a snowstorm. So when it came time for me to put the book together, as I was combing through my notes and my journals and stuff, this one popped out. And it wasn't a too great a leap to take it, stretch it out a little bit, you know, add some anecdotes and put a period at the end of it, you know. So that was good. Now, in other essays, like The World of Yesterday, which is in Junk Shop, which is a long scribe about the elders I knew who fought in World War I when I was a young man. And now that I pulled completely from memory. I love these people so much. I could call them back like they were in the room with me. And so that was kind of a labor of love, and I wept like a schoolboy when I was writing that. But
it is there. It is on the page. You know, the truth does not lie. The truth does not lie. And you have done something extraordinary. I began to realize there was a difference between anecdote and memoir as I read your book, because anecdote has to have a philosophical platform under it. And we always get that with your work. Memoir could be just remembering, reminiscing, but anecdote really has to have a moral to it. And that comes through your writing. And I don't know if you knew it, that or not. I'm just giving you that free. I'm just giving you that free. You're welcome. Now let's have another reading from this junk shop, which is called The Curiosity. How did you say that? The Curiosity of Your Mind? Something like that.
Well, a curiosity. Let's have some more. It's a curiosity shop of the mind. Yeah. Well, you know, I got that from, about 10 years ago at the centennial of the beginning of World War I, all of these marvelous books, historians just flooded the book market with reminiscences of World War I. And I read about 9 of these books, and I really felt like I teleported back into the lives. But you know, I had known so many people that had done that, you know. So So here's a little taste of the world of yesterday. It'll give you an idea of what I'm talking about. My father always said that his first memory was of standing on the couch in his parents' living room, small hands on the back cushion, peering out a picture window at a neighborhood street in Bend, Oregon. There's a slow-moving line of cars and horse-drawn carriages inching its way down the lane. The line of cars is there every day, and every day he stands there and watches. His street is a long one, and at the end of it is the cemetery. He's not allowed to go outside to play. Death is all anyone talks about. Death from a great flu epidemic. Death from a great war just ending. Everyone has lost someone. Most have lost a few. It is 1918. My parents were born during the First World War, my father in 1915, my mother in 1917. I didn't know my grandparents. I was raised on the other side of the continent. When I was in my teens and early 20s, the last of the World War I generation, then in their 70s and above, were all around me and treated with quiet reverence by one and all. Armistice Day, November 11, was still celebrated with great fanfare. On the Lovesick Lake, where I spent my summers, most islands and cottages on the mainland were populated with people from the Between the Wars generation and their remaining elders from World War I. In those years, our summer home on Clovelly Island must have been a comfortable place for the older ones to visit, as most of the look and feel of the place would have been very familiar to them. A big iron and wood barrel butter churn, now used for holding summer flowers, greeted them on the front porch. There was a fully functioning cast iron wood stove in the kitchen that we depended upon for our meals, and smaller wood stoves in the bedrooms for heat. Coal oil lamps burned late into the evenings. There was a sawdust house for preserving ice and an ice box instead of a refrigerator in a nook behind the kitchen away from the heat. A sundial on the front lawn kept good time. The benches and furniture outside and in were all handcrafted by local folk, from local trees and timbers. You know, it was a time when everything in the world was handmade, laughed one old timer when I pointed out a favorite rocking chair constructed from a collection of hickory sticks and branches. They called me a history buff because they needed an easy explanation for a boy who read all the time instead of hammering nails and tinkering with engines. But it would have been impossible to keep up with the adults around me if I didn't study up on their life and times. Every now and then, while sitting on a porch, playing chess, or under a shady tree, watching the world of the lake go by, one of these folks would open up about those days when they were young, young like I was at the time. So once in a while, during a quiet moment, the right question would open a door. I hear you enlisted? Oh, I enlisted because I hated my father, old Max Fisher told me on one of those afternoons. You hated your old man so much you volunteered to go fight in the worst war ever fought, thousands of miles from home? Oh, Christ, yes, he chuckled. Getting thousands of miles away from him was the reason to do it. He was a right mean old so-and-so. He was a farmer. He must have beat me, all of us, within an inch of our lives. I can't tell you how many times. And you thought it safer to take your chances with the Germans? Hell yes, he laughed. And so? So father owned the only motor vehicle in the whole township. He had one of the first motorized tractors, too. He taught me to drive so I could be a useful hand on his farm, which I hated. Anyway, as soon as I got the hang of this driving piece of business, I stole his car and ran away. I knew he'd kill me if he found me, so I drove to a recruitment center all the way down in Oshawa and signed up. I was only 16, but I was the only recruit who knew how to drive, so they took me anyway. Just before I shipped out, I sold the car.
These people, these characters, these extraordinary characters that you have made permanent, honestly, friendship is very, very important to you. And the book speaks about that. At one point, you say how disappointing it was that Herman Melville was not able to make any friends. And through your life, James, you have had such good male friends. I mean, you were a star, actually a musician. You collaborated with other men. You talk to other men about books. You drink with other men. You have done something that isn't typical. And in your book, you say that you believe that men seek isolation and women seek community. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, I think men are suspicious of each other. Mm. They compete with each other. They compete for women or lovers, let's say. They compete in the marketplace. They compete physically all the time. I was a shrimp when I was a kid. I was the smallest kid in school. And when you're a small guy, everyone's a bully. They push you out of the way. They make fun of you in front of everybody and all that. So I think as a survival technique, when I was a little guy, I'd make friends with the biggest guys in school. I didn't plan it that way, you know, but I am the type of short guy that will come up and tweak a horse on its ear. You know, I'll go up and poke a guy in the belly and say, I hear it really angers big guys like you when little guys like me beat the crap out of you, you know, knowing that he could go like that and I would be flying across the room.
I think there's more than that, James. I think that's in the book too, but yeah. I think there's something about the human heart that stays open to people and is not afraid. And that is in your writing. And that is paramount in your life. So it's just more than that. I know that some men, my husband being from the war, was afraid to make men companions for fear that they would be gone, you know.
Right.
So life was different. But I want to tell everyone just a little bit about what you've done. You've adapted the complete adventures and memoirs of Sherlock Holmes for radio. We need to put that on the radio someday. And you had a music management that must have been terrible called Baker Street Limited. Then you had a tabloid for years, and I remember that, Sports Fan Magazine, where you covered all the sports. It was really consummate. And then 15 years, this is the biggest thing, a touring musician, and then you had a popular folk duo. But you had 15 years on the road, and there are some crazy anecdotes in this book about that. What is the name of this duo you had?
We were called the Pheromones, and that's the biological term for the scent that that creatures give off that attracts or disattracts other creatures.
And sometimes you did, and sometimes you didn't.
That's right.
But you sure played. How many venues do you think you played in 15 years?
Well, I know I don't think we ever played less than 200 nights a year. And so we would be like 12 nights on and 3 nights off, that kind of thing. So and it was all across the country. We played at college campuses and bars, venues, and regular music venues of all kinds. And we were topical. We called it when they wanted to say, well, describe what you're doing here, I called it pop relevant cabaret, because we used pop. All of our humor was contained in the songs. So rather than being stand-up comedians, let's say. And so, but we used pop music forms to deliver messages about about the environment and war and all of that stuff. But you know, I found out at an early age, being a shrimp, I found out at an early age that you can tell somebody something as long as you make them laugh. You know,
what? We have to just verify something. I want to just say that James J. Patterson is as tall as anybody right now. He grew up.
Yeah. Well, that's right.
Just want to clear that up for people. You're also the author of 2 previous books, another essay collection, which is Bermuda Shorts, and then the novel Roughnecks. What's the difference between writing a novel and an essay?
Night and day. That novel took 8 years to write. And but those 8 years, I didn't have 8 years at any one time to spend doing anything. So that 8 years was contained in a 30-year swath. I started that novel in my 20s and finished it in my 60s. So
you like it?
You know, it's funny. I have a love-hate relationship with that book. It's the story of a friend of mine who worked at a big bank. He was the youngest vice president this bank had ever had. And he found out one day that these loans, the international loans he had been making, were actually, the money was being siphoned off to go to arms, to go to mercenaries in Central and South America to kill socialists and stuff. And when he learned that he had been unwittingly complicit in something like that, he quit. And he had a real crisis of the soul. And as he went out to North Dakota and Montana and threw rig chain on an oil rig for many years. And I went out and found him. and that's what he was doing. And so when he quit doing that, I went back out there with him, and we went crawled all over the region. And I disguised myself as a roughneck, and I got up on those rigs, and I interviewed people, and all of that. It was a hard book to write because I'm not the type of guy that would do that.
You are. You've done just about everything. You have done. You have a life well lived.
Oh, that's true.
Also, there's an aspect of you which is about film. I like very much the essay, "Do Conservatives Dream of an Electric Jesus?" Because here we see your knowledge of popular culture, which is consummate, and that you are such a film buff. Tell us a little bit about your history with loving film.
You know, I loved the sci-fi movies when I was a kid. You know, The Blob, The Thing from Another Planet, you know, those kind of stuff. And history movies. I'm a history nut. And the essay we're talking about now is I kind of deconstruct Blade Runner. You know, it's a great movie. It's very entertaining. But there's some worrisome things about Blade Runner. A guy falls in love with a replicant. He falls in love with a robot. And what kind of damage do you have to your psyche to fall in love with an inanimate object, you know?
We might find out with this AI thing coming in.
Oh,
this
yeah, that's
it. Going to be relevant more than ever. Mm-hmm. Let us hear a final reading from this very inclusive book.
Oh, you're so kind. Okay, let me find it here. We're going to bring my wife, Rose, into this story, too. You know, when I first wrote this, it was going to be creative nonfiction. So I had changed everybody's name. And when I wrote Bermuda Shorts, I said to Rose, I said, now, look, you're in here, but I can't use your name. I don't want to use your name. So what's your name going to be? And she said, well, call me Rochelle. And so in Bermuda Shorts, her name is Rochelle. And but in this, she said, OK, I don't want to be Rochelle anymore. Call me Rose. And so here it comes. My wife, Rose, and I are discussing a recent visit from a UK buddy of ours, Martin. As Rose and I post-mortem the week we spent with him, she laughs. He seems to be caught up in some kind of miserable loop. Everywhere he turns, things are going sour on the poor guy. I hope it doesn't turn him into a misery guts. In his early 40s, a bit younger than Rose, quite a bit younger than me, Martin finds himself in transition. His job, his love life, his writing all seem to have become tangled up in blue. He's come to America to get out of the rut he's been in, or as they say, to get himself sorted. He's a brilliant man, a trained actor, a good writer despite his dyslexia, and when on his home soil, he's the man you want when you feel a good pub crawl coming on. Philosophically, he can go almost anywhere with the right mental lubrication. So this misery guts thing is a temporary symptom, not his usual self. Also, he has developed a back problem. And if anything will make you miserable, that will do it. I blame his job and his unhealthy alliance with it for his back pain. Too much tension can get you clenched. Nobody wants to be clenched. And getting declenched can be a long and arduous project. The night before he flew home, Rose gave up on us and went to bed, Martin and I sat up late, sipping wine and talking, circling around his various troubles like ravens in the moonlight. Until it all boiled down to one basic bit of advice. Look, I said, first and foremost, you have an obligation to yourself to be happy. Why? For lots of reasons, but primarily because you're no bloody good to anyone if you're miserable, meaning not okay with Martin. Okay with Martin. Yes, happiness is not a self-indulgence. It's a key component to what you bring to the world and what the world can bring to you. Whatever you need to do to get to be happy with Martin, get working on it. You'll just make yourself and everyone else around you miserable until you do. Besides, you'll feel better just knowing you're back in charge. Hate your job? Come up with a plan. Take the pressure your job is putting on you, clenching you up, and put that pressure to work, motivating you to get out, take the pressure off. Easier said than done, I'm sure. But how long can you go on like this? Your love life makes you crazy? Table it. Issue some pink slips. Stop taking calls and answering emails. Just let it die on the vine. After all, how can you be good for so-and-so if you can't be good for Martin? Would that I could, he replied while heaving a sigh of exasperation, looking more and more hopeless, miserable, and forlorn by the second. He stared into a distant corner of the room that I was certain had his current heartthrob's face hidden in it. By the way, I tried to lighten his load. You should enjoy this time between relationships. It won't last long anyway. You'll fall bass-ackwards into something with someone soon enough. But for now, invest some time in crawling back into your own skin. Hang out with my good pal Martin in the interim. Clearly, he's the one needing attention. You're so tangled up with exigencies, contingencies, hypotheses, you haven't noticed that you're really just suffering from neglect. Yes, well, that's the hard part, isn't it? He replied. The commitments pile up and the misery quotient grows. It's hard to tell what the bloody hell to do about it. Well, all I can tell you is stop caring about stuff you don't care about, and you'll feel a whole lot better pretty soon thereafter. The whole wide world is trying to tell you how to cope with it. A woman who's interested will tell you how to make love to her, or how not to, if you can shut up long enough to listen to her. An employer will tell you what they want to hear about you. My point is, get okay with Martin, and the rest of the world will probably get okay with Martin, too. So what is to be done? Martin bravely asks the question of the ages. Beats me, I reply, but here's the hard part, and this I learned the hardest way. When I was a younger man and saw roadblocks at every turn. If it's art you want to make, either through your acting, your writing, or whatever means you choose to express yourself, keep this one thing foremost in your mind. Anyone who suggests that you not make your art, I don't care if it's a best friend, a lover, a mom, or dad, anyone who wants to impose on you priority that takes you away from your work for whatever reason, that person is not your friend, and they're going to have to go. Now, this rudimentary bit of amateur psychology won't work for people with big problems, but it can help maybe overcome the average everyday variety, especially if those troubles have been piling up, earning compound interest on your soul. Anything beyond this is above my pay scale, and I'm quite frankly not qualified to venture one step further than my own personal experiences. But hey, I've been around.
That is the voice of James J. Patterson. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, the Maryland State Arts Council, the Bravada Foundation, Natalie Canivore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavallari.